Welcome to the AZ Wine Guru Podcast. This episode is brought to you by the Acoustic Cellars Lodge. Music, nature, and wine. The only all-inclusive experience of its kind in the Verde Valley AVA. This episode, we're featuring an AZ Wine Guru, Cynthia Snapp, and this was recorded live at her home, the Vineyard View House at the Javelina Leap Estate Vineyards and Winery. Thus, you might hear some different background noises in the podcast, but we've been able to edit it down so it's an acceptable presentation and you can get all the cool information of us conversation with Cynthia. And please, if you appreciate the content of AZ Wine Guru Podcast, please like and subscribe. That helps us. And now, Cynthia Snapp. All right, welcome to the AZ Wine Guru Podcast. And we are sitting here with a true wine guru of Arizona wine, Miss Cynthia Snapp, the most awarded female winemaker in Arizona. And we also have Dawn with me, and she's going to help in this podcast because she's fired up. We're sitting over at Cynthia's house right now, so we're on location. And you might hear the air filter or what have you, the dogs, but it's cool. She's getting ready to take off for the summer and go up to her lake house, and so we wanted to catch her before she goes. And we're sitting here just having a conversation, and all of a sudden Dawn's like, hey, wait, this is our podcast. We need to get her now. So here we are. Hi, Cynthia. How are you?
Hi, guys.
Good. Well, welcome, and thank you for doing this with us.
I love it.
So we were just talking about how it all started. So take us back to why were you intrigued by wine in the first place? You mentioned something about your mother, your grandmother was in wine.
My grandmother worked at a vineyard along the river, mm-hmm. across from France. She was there when they came across and freed her, because she was, it was slave labor, really.
Yeah.
They were in the camp, and she was working in a winery, and what she did was cleaning out barrels. But she said the family was winemakers. They were generations of winemakers. I think the family's name, she told me, was Schnepps or something like that. And they were very nice to her and my mother. And she told me the story only several years before she passed away. But all growing up, she told me stories, but she didn't tell me that one. She told me all kinds of stories, but that's the one she didn't tell me till much later. And so
all the time knowing you're a winemaker.
It's strange that she didn't tell me sooner.
And she died at 101, right?
Yes, almost 101.
It's a good long life. That's what good wine will do for you.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you what.
Feistiness, like you.
Yeah, she was very feisty. She was very opinionated. She taught me mushroom hunting and medicinal plants a little bit.
Oh, sweet.
Stuff like that. She made everything. You know, she's European. And she spoke a few languages by the end of the war. And she was a real influence in my life. I didn't have a store-bought egg, I don't think, till I was 12.
Wow.
You know, and she had her little, they hung around like all the same people from the same country, you know, that had met in the camps or whatever. And some had farms and some had this, so there was always trading going on, you know, fresh milk, mm-hmm. that was unfiltered milk. And she was a seamstress, so she, everything was sewed, you know, you could show her a picture in Vogue and she'd make that for you, just like that, make her own pattern, everything. She grew everything. She grew enough food for an army. She canned everything, preserved everything. If you were not feeling well, you're going to get a tea. There was never any thing in my family when we had a lot of parties and dinners. There was never anything like, oh, no, don't give the kids any drinks. I mean, in Europe, get a little and you have food and
exactly.
you grew up with it. She actually likes whiskey, but figure.
So the
anyways,
kids got whiskey too.
No, we didn't get that. We didn't get that. We got vino, but yeah, she was really cool. She's very determined, a very hard worker. She loved animals. She loved to be growing her garden. She was just a do-it-all person, kind of like that's
what
where
does
I
that
get
sound
it.
Like?
I know
exactly.
I know.
Like you just told us about building this, the drywall in your new closet, and this this beautiful barn door for it, and then harvesting the grapes, and also making your way in this industry with that's pretty male-dominated.
Well, yeah, and
when
I,
you started,
I and by you the were... way, I don't know if I'm the most awarded winemaker. Probably not now
in Arizona.
In Arizona, I don't know, but back then there was there weren't that many female winemakers when I started making wine.
I think the last time I spoke with Lucas about it, he still thought that was the case.
Mm-hmm.
And even to your point, right now there's not that many female winemakers in Arizona. In retrospect, in comparison, right? But
yeah.
So when you got here in the Verde Valley,
mm-hmm.
it was basically 2002, 2003, something around that time
when
frame.
John, I've been here since the 80s in the area.
Okay.
But the
when it all started for the winemaking.
Oh
you
yeah,
and
it
then,
it had to be. I want to say around 2003 or 2004. No, it had. It's more than that. Our vines are almost 20. 13th license.
Yeah.
Now there's like 200, right?
Yeah,
yeah, something
so,
like that.
You were just telling us about John. What's his last name?
Marcus. Yeah, he was the first up here.
What was the name of his vineyard?
Echo Canyon. Yeah.
Right. Okay. And then Rod was working with him in the fields, and
yeah.
You over working and pulling
I
grapes
came over
too.
There, yeah, came over there and harvest and bottled with them, and yeah, and I think that was the wine that came out of Echo Canyon originally was. Your eyes kind of just got wide because you're like, oh my God, good, very good wine can grow here. And we were all very impressed with it. And, you know, things went different down there, and the vineyard is no longer, I think, down there now. But it was the first time that we saw what could happen.
In Arizona.
In Arizona. Northern Arizona.
Yeah, northern. Yeah, central northern.
Yeah. Yeah. So.
And now the Verde is an actual AVA.
It's an AVA.
Crazy.
And don't forget, they used to, when the conquistadors came through here, they didn't call it the Verde Valley. They call it the Valley of Grapes because there's so many wild grapes up there. If you go along the creek, you'll see all kinds of wild grapes.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, they don't produce anything, really. You know, but occasionally you'll see some little grapes,
Whoa.
You know, on the vines. I guess if you were starving, you could
yeah,
eat them, but
it
wouldn't do
you
any good. But yeah, they're out there. They're all along there. And I've seen some old fences with, you know, with some very old vines on it.
Whoa.
I have one of the old, over 100-year-old vines out there on my porch. From Sedona, from Hancock Ranch.
No kidding.
Wow. Yeah, from Mary Hancock standing beside it. I have that picture as well.
Wow.
So, you know, there has been stuff go here. But don't forget, we had Prohibition
uh-huh.
way before Prohibition, which really affected
yeah.
our state and the grape growing process.
We were one of the biggest producers in the continent, right? This area?
We were.
That's what Lucas
yeah.
said.
And is it true
he
that we
know.
Burned all the vines?
They told him
they
about
did.
So that
yeah.
we could be a state, right?
They did.
Yeah, they instigated
they,
prohibition
right,
early.
Right. It was just horrible.
Pitiful.
Right?
Right.
Exactly. Horrible.
Jeez.
When you think about how long it takes to grow, you know, vines and get your grapes out of them, and then, you know, table grapes, I guess, is okay, but, you know.
Yeah, we'd have had
horrible.
Some of the most oldest established vines in the country
yeah.
at that time, probably.
Yeah. There was a big vineyard, the name escapes me, but over there on the Loop Road, he had Zinfandel over there for a long time. He would have to ask the particulars, Rod would know, but, you know, I'm not that great with dates, sometimes names, especially
so
older.
Zinfandel, you mentioned.
Yeah.
So your family vineyard here, Javelina Leap.
Yeah.
It's a fabulous place. Any of you listening, if you've never been, this is the place to be up here in the Verde Valley. family-owned, second-generation winemaker, Lucas. You hear that reference, and that's Cynthia's son. And Lucas is making incredible wine now, too. But tell us how it got to the point where it could even be something to pass down, because we were just discussing how tough this business is. Yeah. You say it's a romantic vision for most people when they think about, oh, I'm going to own a winery. Good luck with that.
Honestly, right? Now when I stand out on my deck and I can see not only our vineyards, but everybody else's from the elevation we're at, yes, I am looking out over the ever-evolving masterpiece of my life, of our lives. But how did it come? How did it? I don't know. I mean, we just were hoping. I mean, honestly, you're working so hard and it's so all-consuming. Because you're wearing so many hats, mm-hmm. You know, you're producing, you're growing, you're processing, you're bottling, you're marketing, you're wearing all these different hats. So you don't have time to worry about it. But it did come to the point where like, oh my gosh, I can see that there's no possible way that we could do this kind of winemaking for the rest of our lives. You know, because we get old. Your body gets old, it gets sore. Especially the way we make it. We don't just push a button and everything happens. It's by hand.
Hard work.
All the punch downs. I mean, I can remember doing midnight punch downs, having 34 of those white vats to punch down all by myself. Jeez. When I had worked all day in the cellar. Many times. Many, many times.
Tell us more about that, because people don't know what that means.
Okay, so when you're
grapes come in off of the field,
you destem them, you inoculate them with your chosen yeast. They go into a vat for us. We use pretty much half-ton vats because I'm really good with yeast varietals. It's kind of was my specialty, and understanding how they work together, and then learning what's coming off the vineyard and how to work that. It's very hard to explain. It's not something you can teach, really.
Yeah.
So it's something you just get. You get it, and it's in your brain, or you don't get it. So you have all
because
these vats.
Because the grapes will come in with natural yeast on them,
right,
too.
Right, and you can't have that. That has to do with temperature. So you have to suspend them a little bit, get them in there, and then some are coming in, some are getting ready to be pressed. It's all over the place. You have to be organized. So you come in, and at one time in the cellar, inoculated vats, 34 of them. Now, every 4 to 6 hours, it just depends on if you've got a problem child or not, or if it's all going good. But for sure, every 6 hours around the clock, for a week, 2 weeks, however long the fermentation lasts, you have to get in there and punch it down with a punch down tool. So it's a paddle with a foot, and you push down the cap into the liquid underneath. Let the gas escape, cool it down, you know, make sure that everything is kind of suspended in the liquid so the yeast can do its job and not get suffocated and die and all that stuff. I could go on and on. But anyways, to make it
a
stuck fermentation you don't want. So you do everything you can to prevent that, and that's just a whole podcast in itself. So going on with it, you have to do it, or else you can lose you can get a stuck fermentation. Then it's a real problem, because now you got a stuck fermentation. You might have to restart. Now you got more grapes coming in. You got more grapes going in the press. It's just a nightmare. So you don't want it to happen. And, you know, you're tired. You're mm-hmm. tired. I mean, this goes on from August into October. There's no
non-stop,
stopping.
Right.
Non-stop.
Middle of the night, all kinds of things.
You cannot miss. You cannot miss. So, and there's everything else in between, but the punch downs are very, very important. There's nobody else to do it. And if you don't have anybody else to do it, you have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
it's not optional.
It's not, there's no option. You get your ass out of bed, you crawl down there. It doesn't matter if how little sleep. Sometimes I can remember thinking, is it night or morning?
Which is it?
Yeah, which is it? Because you're just like that way. So I can remember sitting on the floor, just like in that movie, A Bottle Shock, sitting on the floor. I wasn't saying, it's brown. I was saying, oh, I was crying, because it was like, how am I going to do it? I'm so exhausted, and there's nobody to help, and Rod's hauling grapes, and there's nobody around, and I'm like, how can I do it? Well, you have a good cry. You sit on the floor. You look around. You think, okay, put on some music.
Fine.
Get to work. And you just push through and you just do the punch downs. Can you imagine? It takes 34 vats. I mean, I just remember that number because that was when I sat on the floor.
That was when it was like, that's when it got you.
Yeah, that's when it got me. Like, you know, and then you try to take turns, you try to have crew, but you know, at that time there wasn't a lot of options.
It's hard to count on people anyway.
Yeah, and really hard to get guys to listen to you.
I want you to talk about your experience as a female. Because I don't think that's expressed very often, and I really don't think that most people understand. So
yeah, because you were a pioneer, right? I mean, in Arizona, you're a pioneer.
We're a wine pioneer, Rod and
Big
I, yes.
Time.
Yes.
Yeah, both of you, and you particularly because of what you're just expressing.
Yeah.
How do you get them to take you serious?
Well,
so how did all that work out?
It didn't. It was horrible.
It did in the end.
It's, you know, as if you haven't got enough to think about.
Uh-huh.
Now you've got to worry about getting people to follow your instructions.
Right.
You know, and yes, I'm sure that I have a nasty reputation of being an absolute bitch. But, you know, what else are you going to do? Because people have to listen. You have to make them understand. Your livelihood and everybody's and anybody else's job in the tasting room depends on it.
Exactly.
And it's not that. It's my vision for the wine. It's our Javelina Leap reputation for the wine. It's a lot lying on it, you know? So it's if somebody doesn't understand why you're so intense, then because they've never had a passion that they've had to put out there into somebody else's hands like that.
Right.
So it's really hard, and yes, it's really hard to get guys at that time. I think it's a lot better now. And they just didn't take me seriously.
I think it is better now. I've worked in two wineries, Stronghold, one of them, where there's a female winemaker.
Mm-hmm.
And she knows her stuff. Came from Missouri, she's good. But she was in a big organization there in a larger facility. And also we have the college here and the program, so everybody's coming out learning, and so there's more knowledge. At that time, you didn't even have any formalized...
Yeah.
Were you formally trained in it?
I have a pretty high IQ, so when I'm passionate about something, I delve into it 250%. I'm not like the, I'll just get it done kind of person. I'm all in or all out. It's just that way for me. I'm like completely absorbed into what I'm doing if I love it, and then there's just no stopping. I'll talk to people, I'll research night and day, you know, with nonstop.
Yeah.
And
just consumed
with everything, and that's how I was with the winemaking. From the first day that I remember my first wine that I ever made, it was some god awful shit grapes that came in, and Rod's was gonna I think just get rid of them, and I'm like, and he said, "What? Well, you want to make it? Here you go, do that." Well, I made it. Nice. I made it. I finished it. I have finished grapes at 29 Barriques, just from nurturing them. You know, knowing what to do. I just had a second nature to do it. I know what to do. I have a secret that I do for processing that, and the wine is dry as can be.
Okay.
And no stuck fermentations. So, yeah,
I
know what I'm doing.
So
for those that don't know, Barriques.
Nobody knows, because to tell them anybody else around here the process, nobody would go to that length.
Yeah.
Nobody would go to that length to do it. They would just say,
this
make
is
it
garbage,
into, make
yeah.
it in, yeah. Make it into, like, something.
Sangria.
Yeah.
But also,
it'll be a mixer.
Explain what that means.
So Barriques is the sugar count in the grapes, which leads me to the next question I had for you. So we're here in the Verde Valley.
Mm-hmm.
We have a pretty aggressive monsoon season. It's a beautiful monsoon season, and it's pretty consistent.
Right.
To your point, every year the grapes turn out different, no matter what. I mean, mm-hmm. it's really difficult, right? And depending on season and the monsoons. So what I've been exposed to a couple times, and tell me how this worked for you, when did you figure it out, but how the rain affects that Barriques number dramatically during monsoon season. So were you pretty particular of monitoring, and then, okay, it's like some guys go out and pick at 3 a.m. here during monsoon season based on what the sugar levels are.
Yep. You have to.
Yeah.
You have to. if it's a heavy downpour, that's where you get your drop in bricks.
Yeah, because the water uptakes into the grate.
Right. Yep. Soaks it up, they swell up, and they're diluted. We usually have turned the water down a bit on the watering just before harvest. That's how we concentrate the flavor. If you get a downpour, you have to wait a couple of days.
Oh, interesting. So your irrigation water, you cut that back too?
Yeah.
A week or two before?
Well, no. No, days.
Oh, days. Okay. Yeah.
No, days before. So you can do that. But if it downpours, you just have to wait. And then you might have to make a decision. If it's pouring, and then it's pouring again, and then it's pouring again, now you're looking at rot. Now you're looking at all those kinds of problems.
Right.
Oh, wow. So you have to watch the weather. You have to look at your, you have to walk in your vineyard and look, and not just the one vineyard vine on the corner.
Right.
You have to walk
inspect
the rows.
It all.
That's what I learned from Nikki Pruse, Stag's Leap winemaker. She's probably retired now, but she was like the god to me. I'm sure she's got to a lot of winemakers, but she was a woman one.
Stag's Leap District in California.
Yes. The nice. Real Stag's Leap. The yeah. true Stag's. She was the vineyard manager there when the Judgment of Paris and all that came, I believe.
Wow.
I believe.
Wow.
So she was here, and she was on holiday, but she, you know, if you look at this steep vineyard, it's very like the original old steep vineyard at Stag's Leap.
In California.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a deep pitch.
Yeah,
right.
Deep pitch, and so, and she walked all over the whole rows, everything, and she, and it really dawned on me that that's why she makes good wine, because she
she's
walks
in the vineyard.
The vineyard.
At her grapes, yeah.
And when I went there, her husband Christopher, Dimitri, I guess Dimitri, he's from a wine family too, Cab, he said. That she is obsessed with that. And
being in the vines.
Being in the vines and doing that. And that's the way you see it. If you're not walking in the vines, how do you know? She would just to that time, that the last time that we were talking to him and were there, she still would call that particular vineyard, pick to here and stop, pick to there and stop.
Wow.
Yes. And
because portions of it are not ready for her yet.
And she would let the, as much as you have these ideas about, you know, what kind of yeast you want to use and where you want to take the wine, you still are, your hands are tied because when the harvest comes in, that's when you can really make your decisions, honestly. And that's what she did. She said that the wine is made on how the harvest comes in.
Hmm.
And so...
So she could adjust her plan based on
the
condition of the grapes when they get to you.
If you had this perfect, you know, it's all... For me personally, now I'm talking. Let's say I was making a Tempranillo or a Cab Franc or something. Any one that we have made that I made in the past. I would have the first experience when I first made the wine from that particular vineyard, and I kept them separate, so I never mixed vineyards. So they were all pure varietals from single vineyards.
Mm.
It was a science project for me, really.
Nice.
Because how can you possibly take it to the next level if you don't know what you've got in the first place? So let's see what this tastes like. Let's see what this tastes like, the single pure varietal from a single vineyard tastes like. So we bought grapes from Wilcox and brought them up, and now we have... Before our vines were matured. And well, by the time I was making wine, we had our own grapes. So we didn't, but we still came up, brought them up from down south and everything. So we would... you have them coming in, and then you taste the wine, you make it the best you can, try not to be too fancy, try to do like a good, basic, strong yeast that's well known, that's established, that you could count on, that you know you can handle in the conditions of your own cellar. in terms of heat and cooling and, right. you know, moving things around. It's like a Tetris game down there sometimes.
Yeah, you constantly jump, right. moving crap, barrels, this everywhere.
I always had to have the wine that needs to be pressed on closest to the door, and the wine that's just been inoculated, the must that's just been inoculated, the grapes that is the must in the back, so they kind of...
It just keeps moving. Yep.
You kind of organize it like that. Who's too cold needs to come out and warm up in the sun. Who's too hot needs to go back in the back corner of the cellar under where it's really chilly. That kind of thing is what I did. But anyway, so you make you do use a strong, good yeast, and then you see what you've got. And then from there, then your artistic artistry sets in. Because, okay, now you can see it'd be nice if I could bring out a little more of that or push back a little more of that. And you hope that you can get a similar harvest, but you still got Mother Nature. But at least you know, kind of after a couple of years of getting it from one particular vineyard or another, you know, you get to learn what comes out of there. Yes. How does it come out? How does it show up? How does it ferment? You know, you start to see like little patterns with slight differences because it's Mother Nature, right?
Right.
But then you say, okay, like with Syrah, I always wanted to try to bring out a little more violet on that. You know, the nuances, you start tasting it and your palate just takes off and you're on your own little world in there in the cellar. And it's really fun, but it's really hard because you can't always do what you want. You're out there and you say, okay, I want these grapes to come in at, say, 25 bricks, 25.5 bricks, or 26 bricks. Anywhere in that range would be perfect.
Which would give you about a 13% alcohol.
Yeah, 26 would be even better because you get more flavor out of that, more color and everything. But you can't always do it. But anyways, you get that in, you put your order in, you have a contract, you pay some money down, you're waiting for the harvest, you get them home, they're 29 fucking bricks.
Oh, jeez.
So now you're okay. Oh, now you got to change everything you're doing. Now it's going to be a problem. Now you got to worry about all kinds of things. So now you got to make sure that you incorporate a yeast into that's going to be able to handle that high bricks.
All that sugar, yeah.
And then you've got to really take care of it in terms of temperature. And then you've really got to be diligent with your punch downs. Maybe you got to do it more than six hours. Maybe you got to do it four. Maybe you need to do a whole entire pump over. But I can remember half of the time not even having a pump to pump over.
Really?
Because it kept breaking down, and the guys working here kept washing things and spraying water on the
pump.
Electronic, and it would break it. Wow. So guess how I had to do it? 5-gallon buckets.
No way.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, my God.
Open up a double. Oh, my God.
Every single one. Yeah.
Backbreaking.
Yeah. I was in there from... I'd be in there from like dawn till dusk doing every vat, like the vats
manual
that I had to do.
Manual
pump overs. And then I found the stainless steel turkey baster. You know those turkey basters?
Oh, my
word. Holes in it.
Yeah.
So that was like my aeration for a while.
Wow.
Yeah. Because we were broke. We had spent everything we had. We were doing everything we had. You know, the pump broke down. It's got to go. Nobody can read Italian. It's all the instructions are in a different language. It's a constant challenge.
Oh, my God.
So you just got to deal with it. You got to do whatever you can do, and you've got to do it now. You can't work. You can't just put your hand in
yourself.
Yeah,
it's not like, okay, Tuesday we'll go get that fixed.
No. Yeah. No, you got to jump on it any way you can. So that's what happened.
That's nuts.
We did that for a few years. I remember my best guy, Jeremy, used to work here. I mean, we were the best team for that because, you know, he had no problem. It was one guy that had no problem. If I needed to be done in a certain way, it would get done that way. We would do it together, whatever, you know. And then we had kids, the guys from the college come in for their practicum, used to come over here. That worked really good. But then I had some real doozies.
So I was one of those kids from the college when I first got my credit hours in. Yeah, kid. And I remember, you probably don't even remember this, maybe you do, but I was here helping pick grapes for my first experience of getting in the vineyard. And you were telling everybody, and there was a whole group of people here, you know, because everybody volunteers too, to come in, all the neighbors and whatever. And you're like, okay, nothing but solid black goes in these vats because this is how we're doing it. And I'm looking at some, and they're a little purple, and you came over and took one bunch on my hands and said, that's not black. I want it to be black. And so then the other ones all go in the side bin, and that's what I was telling you. I got some of those afterwards. Lucas let me take them home, and that was my first batch. I made Zinfandel.
What a nightmare.
It was so funny, though, because you were so particular, and I was like, what in the hell? I mean, it's purple. Right?
This is how you get great wine.
I know.
That's the lengths I would go to, though. And the thing is I had such a plan for it, and, of course, Zinfandel is notorious for uneven ripening. Yep. It is...
It's
the next hardest grape to Pinot Noir.
A delicate grape to grow.
Yeah.
And you guys specialize in that on your estate, Zinfandel.
Yep.
Hardly anybody else that I know does Zinfandel.
Yeah, because they don't want to work that hard. Yeah. They're afraid.
Because it's not easy, right?
It's not easy. Oh, no. In the end, you're picking twice, maybe even three times on some of them. Because the top field is 80 or 90 feet above the bottom field, and it gets... the sun first, so that's the first ripening. So, but if you wait till it all catches up, that will be
gone.
So the way I used to like it is I used to like the clusters really dark as possible, and then I used to like a little bit of bunches in there that were not raisins, but kind of a little pruny, just looking a little like they're going that way. And then you put that in with the others. And then if you do have some light fruit, in the end, it mixes in, you got something great. And I did make great Zinfandel from this place. But it's really hard. It's really hard.
So that's interesting. So you have some that are already drying or getting close.
Well, they're not dry. They're just kind of like
a little bit. You can see them wilted a little bit.
Creased.
It? I don't know.
Just slightly... going that way, but not that way.
Not already.
Because you don't... what happens if you put the raisins in? Let me tell you, because I know from experience. That's not good. If you get the real raisins, like when they're like too far gone, the past pruny, you get them in there, and you'll be taking your Brix tests, and they'll go down, 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 and then all of a sudden those raisins soak up, lose their sugar. Your yeast gets freaked out and your sugar doesn't drop. I've even seen it go up.
Really?
Yes. I've even seen it go up. I saw it one time go up and I realized what happened.
Oh, wow.
I'm like, shit. Now what I do? So, yeah, I learned my lesson. So it was all those little things, you know, that you learn. But, yeah, being out there and seeing the fruit, if you have something in mind that you want to do, a certain kind, a certain way you want to put it together, and maybe it's the first pick, and then you're going to have another pick coming behind it here on the estate with the Zin, and then you're going to use a couple of different yeasts. Maybe you've got chosen. I used to like to use the medium toast Hungarian barrels on the Zin, and then put some of it in a little bit more neutral oak. Maybe even French oak, something that's a little more like a two-year-old or something.
Yeah.
And, so there's all kinds of things like that. And all that is laid out in my mind, in my little notebook. And you hope that you can achieve it, but it takes intense organization to make all that happen. You know, and... Yeah. Of course, everything goes wrong in the meantime. This breaks, that bolt breaks, you got to find it, and you're right in the middle of pressing, you know, the bladder on that old Wilmus press we used to use.
Yeah,
oh my God.
Amazing.
Anyways, thank God the guys don't have to do that. But anyway, somehow we did it.
The new press is
sweet.
We did
it.
Every bottle of wine should not be less than $100. I don't care who makes it.
Yeah, right. If you actually count labor and time, right?
Right. It, when people say, oh, you know, I wouldn't pay more than I get my, you know, box wine for $12. I'm like, good. Good for you.
Somebody still worked their ass off on that wine,
right.
too.
That's right. Right. It's labor intensive.
So tell me, have you been involved or were you involved with Lucas when he got on this adventure of champagne?
Oh my gosh.
Because you guys are producing gold award champagne in an authentic way, which nobody's doing that, right? Everybody makes wine and then carbonates it.
My entry into wine was not red or white wine. It was champagne.
Oh, it was.
I had a friend I had a friend that got me really into the champagne and taught me a lot about the champagne.
Wow.
And used to be involved in buying champagne and from France and stuff. And we used to get wild champagne by the case. We used to have see a party.
Yeah,
right.
So, and lots of beautiful rosé champagnes back then. Way back, this is years ago, many years ago. So, I always, and Rod too, we always thought it would be great someday to make a method sparkling. And it never was in the cards for us because we just had too much on our plates to even go there. And by the time our bodies gave out, we got too old to do it, we didn't want to go there. But I always wanted to. Get a call. We're up at the cabin. Get a call from Luke. By the way, I made champagne. What?
Yeah.
I made it for you, Mom. Like, aww.
Amazing champagne.
Yes. And, well, we hadn't tasted it yet. We had no idea. And like, he says, he got with the guy from France, the Carneros guy. And,
yeah.
You know, did the tutoring.
Yeah, he consulted with him and did the whole learning process.
The whole thing. That's my boy. That's exactly how I would do it. Is just research it, hooked up with a guy to mentor him.
Yep.
And he did it. And then we're like, how good could it really be? Probably not that
good. Best champagne I've ever had in my life.
So we taste it. We finally get to taste it. Wow.
It's pretty spectacular.
Blown away.
Spectacular, yeah.
Yeah.
I remember I was
playing. Double gold right away.
Yeah, and he did it, and he's done it twice.
Yeah.
Gold at the San Francisco Chronicle, so that's a national competition at the highest level.
It's actually international.
Is it international? Yeah. Okay, wow.
San Francisco Chronicle is the biggest wine competition in America, and they never have, I don't think I've ever seen it, less than 7,000 wines.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Wow.
Crazy.
Yeah.
I remember when he told me he was going to do it. We had just played one of your member events.
Yeah.
And we're shooting the shit afterwards and having some wine. And he's like, hey, man, I'm going to make champagne. And I'm like, cool, dude. Let's do it. I'm with you. I think it's going to be great. I said, how are you going to do that? He goes, I'm going to learn from a guy. He's going to teach me. And I'm like, sweet. So then after the fact, right, and I hadn't seen him in multiple months, and then I was like, how's it going with that? He goes, no, I'm doing it. It's for real. We're doing it. And so that process is interesting. If you've never seen it, champagne has a thing you have to do where it's what's called riddling.
Yep.
Where you have to turn the bottle.
Yep. Riddling, disgorging, all that.
Yeah, there's a whole specific process involved. And what's intriguing, and many people might not know this, so the wine is already made. Is that right?
Yeah.
So you choose a wine that you want to then turn into champagne?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And how does that work?
So your wine is already made. It's finished wine.
Okay.
And if you can hold the wine correctly without it, you know, off in some vinegar journey... because all wine wants to become vinegar in the end, but so you have to be able to suspend that and keep it, and then if you can do that, then you can use that wine to make the champagne. And method just means that you're doing it in the old way, where you're doing riddling and you're doing going through all those, the disgorging, all, and you're not just adding
carbonation.
Right. You're going through the whole process step by step.
The authentic champagne process.
Every 6 hours, right. All those things.
Yeah. Every 4 to 6 hours, you're turning it a quarter turn every 4 to 6 hours. So it's very, very involved. And the outcome is spectacular. I mean, I finally got cut off one day, and Rod and Luke told me, "You just can't help yourself, Mom, for all the champagne." Yeah. We have a sparkling club now. You know, this is allocated.
It's already.
Oh my God!
This is allocated. You can't have somebody else's stuff.
That's hilarious.
So my
God, got cut off.
So I always make sure that he always tells me when he's, you know, disgorging and when I can go down there. And then I do, don't worry, I get my cases of champagne. But the sparkling champagne that he's making, I could definitely drink a bottle every night of that. And
me too.
Yeah, it's so good.
It's crisp, it's light, it doesn't taste like any champagne I've ever had in my life.
So Luke and Rod told me I have to go to the store and buy cheap stuff.
What is wrong with them?
Because no. I can't drink the
good stuff.
The good stuff that's allocated to our wife.
Yeah, it's already sold, right? That's hilarious.
But now he's making more, so I can have it when I want it.
Yeah, he said he's going to focus all the Zinfandel now on the property. The estate Zinfandel is all going to go into champagne.
Yep, because it's so good as that.
I love it.
And it eliminates the problem of the double picking, the uneven ripening, because you need it to be 19 bricks to make sparkling.
Oh,
so
interesting.
Yeah, so you can pick it early. I mean, you can.
So you're maximizing your harvest.
Yes, making the best use out of our vineyard.
Wow.
And the end product is spectacular.
That's great.
And now he's making a Blanc de Blanc. He's got a Blanc de Blanc. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's coming out. So, and I think
that one might have been what he let me smell. I don't know.
Yes.
So,
that was that.
Yes.
That intoxicating, hedonistic smell
so
that was
good.
Coming out of the winery.
Yes.
Yeah. That's the one.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the riddling process, when you turn the bottle, what is it that's settling?
It's, since the bottle is on an angle, and it's been, there's new yeast in it, and when you do a quarter turn of the bottle, it sends the yeast down towards the neck and cap, and that's what you're going to disgorge.
The plug,
yeah. Yeah, the plug, yeah.
Wow.
And then when they freeze it, the yeast is trapped there, and then that's what they disgorge. Yeah.
So what else could we say as we wrap up? What would you say, after all of this extensive journey in winemaking, what has been the best thing for you out of it? Because you mentioned artistry, and you are an artist at a very high level, and a collector, and so you've got a palette of sophistication that most people won't even ever be able to experience. So what has winemaking done in your life, or what do you really feel you got from the experience and the lifestyle that you've created as a winemaker?
A really sore back. No, just kidding. Well, I feel very blessed to be where I am now, and to have my family, my entire family involved, even my grandsons, my daughter-in-law, Kim, who's running the wine club, Luke, who's taken the baton for winemaking. I think the whole thing for me is to see how it's become a real legacy. The family.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really, to me right now, about my family. And how they have
embraced it.
And how we've got the third generation on the ground here at Javelina Leap. Because after all that Rod and I have done, all the blood, sweat, and tears that we have, and all the struggle we have gone through, that mountain that we had to climb to just survive.
Just to make it, right?
Now is being taken care of and being nurtured by the next generation.
Yeah.
And I think that is the beautiful thing for me. And of course, I have stories for years. I mean, the journey, really.
Yeah.
When they say it's not, it's really about the journey, it really is. Because the journey was the whole life. And now, I love watching Luke do his winemaking when I, you know, making the champagne. Kim does awesome with the wine club. The boys are involved.
Their new snow cone business.
Their snow cone business. They're taking up the entrepreneur.
Adorable.
Hit the third generation, so they're out there with the Reed Bros snow cone.
Yep, Reed Brothers snow cones. You can get them at Javelina Leap. Plug.
Cracks me up. They just crack me up. And, you know, they've been smelling, you know, when we take the bung out of the barrel to see it or smell it or whatever happens, they've been smelling that. They've been sitting on barrels, smelling barrels since they were three. Yeah.
They're growing up much. Literally in it.
Very in cool. it, yes.
So cool.
They've made their first wine.
What? Mm.
Yes, of course, they're little, but they Luke brought some grapes up and to his house and had them go through the punch down process and the yeast, and yeah, of course they can't have it right now, but they can lay down till they're 21 and then they can say, this is the wine you made when you were 4 years old.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So cool.
They get down there. I've got pictures of them punching down with Luke, you know, getting, they've been grown up in it. Yeah.
Getting their hands in it.
Yes. Yeah.
I love it. I was playing, performing here the other day, and that was right when they got their snow cone machine. So the one comes up right in the middle. I'm in the middle of a song, but he just walks over with his snow cone and just hands it to me. And I'm like, well, thanks, buddy. I'm like, is this for me? He goes, yep. And he didn't say much, and he just turns and walks away. And then I look down, and I see what's up, and I'm like, oh. All right, everybody. Well, we have snow cones now. So everybody go down, and Reed Brothers Snow Cones is in business.
You know, Luke's really doing so well because, you know, Luke grew up with a lot of chores and responsibilities when he was little. But he's doing it with them too, and I think it's so valuable. You know, they have their things that they have to do. They're learning about how to handle money.
Yeah.
So Luke bought the snow cone machine.
Yeah.
So the money that they make, a portion has to be saved. A portion has to go to pay back for the snow cone machine, the loan. And then a certain portion they get to spend on whatever they want. So they learn money management, which is very valuable. You know, Emmett's 8 and Jillian's 4. And they're in it together, and they do it together. And they learn how to be in business together at a very young age.
Great.
It gives them skills that you wouldn't think it would be. Yes, they play and they are kids and they do their things, but this is a very valuable thing that they have to know. And I was brought up that way,
right,
with being responsible like that. So, you know, well, I think it's very valuable.
And to start a winery, you literally gave everything you had to do this thing, right?
Oh, yeah.
And you were both successful before you decided to go down this journey.
Yes.
And I remember one winemaker I was speaking to, I said, so what advice would you have for somebody who wants to think about opening a winery? He says, well, let me tell you, if you want to make a small fortune in wine, you better start with a huge one.
Yeah.
Because you just don't make the money in it, right? And then it's typically second generation where it starts to be nurtured.
Yeah.
And then maybe, if you're lucky, a third generation can sustain and
it
then be involved in a process of something that's actually happening.
It has to be a passion. Yeah. You don't do this for the idea that you're going to flip it or whatever. This has to be a real passion. You have to love what you're doing. You have to like the lifestyle.
Yes.
You have to be into the lifestyle.
Because it's all inclusive.
That's
right.
Right.
It's consuming.
It's all consuming. It's not easy. And Rod will often say to people, say, you know, to talk to him about the fact that you're doing it. He says, oh, I'll pray for you. That's what he says. But you can do it, but it has to be you. It has to be really you. Not, you know, it really has to be. If you love farming, if you like being outside, if you like multitasking, if you like doing all these things, then do it. And if you're passionate about it, if it's your dream, then do it. I mean, we started way too late in our lives to do it, but we did it.
Yeah.
We climbed that mountain. Thank God.
And the results are very powerful.
Yeah.
You guys have done a great job. Well, thank you for taking time to speak to us today.
So fun.
And a thank you again to Cynthia for sitting down with us for this fun conversation. Hope this was informative and fun for you to listen to as well. Make sure you keep up with what's happening with the AZ Wine Guru on the website, azwineguru.com. And again, if you appreciate the content, we appreciate you supporting by clicking follow and subscribing, giving us 5 stars, leaving us good reviews. All those things help to continue this podcast of incredible, amazing Arizona winemakers all over the state. And again, thank you to the Acoustic Cellars Lodge for supporting the AZ Wine Guru podcast. The Acoustic Cellars Lodge, the most unique, all-inclusive experience in the Sedona, Verde Valley, AVA wine country. If you haven't joined and stayed a weekend up there, get that on your list and get it reserved ASAP because it is a fantastic experience. Thank you, Acoustic Cellars Lodge. And until next time, cheers.